For Friday, April the 13th, 2007. Hope that Friday the 13th is not prophetic. We're going to roadmap this a bit. We're going. We've got several different items on the agenda, and we'll start out in the order in which they're printed here. Although there's some paperwork being worked on House Bill 2241, so we may have to skip over that if it's not ready by the time we get to it. So I will begin by opening a work session on House Bill 3119. Council Kalmanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Before the committee are the dash twos to 3119, and the dash twos delete the clerk's immunity for refusing to remove or redact extraneous information from a properly filed instrument. The bill requires clerks to record and make available for inspection instruments without regard to whether they contain non-required information, and it offers immunity from civil and criminal liability when clerks record instruments that contain non-required information. So it really just changed the wording a bit. And that is it.
Okay. This is a bill that has been before us before, along with a couple things relating to recording of documents. It was brought forward by the county clerks and got set over several times, and finally we kept told the fellow from the county clerks who had been coming patiently to be available for us in work session and provide extra backup that we would get to his bill eventually, and but he didn't need to keep coming, so we don't have that resource. I think this is quite a limited bill. It allows for the clerks, or it eliminates judgment calls on their part about so-called extraneous information in recorded documents. Is there any discussion of House Bill 3119?
Amendments three times.
Do we have someone here? From
the
oh, very good. We do have someone here. Please come forward.
Good. Thank you.
Very good. If you could identify yourself for the record, we're in work session, but we do invite people who have an interest in the bill to help us, guide us a bit.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. I'm Jan Coleman. I'm the Yamhill County Clerk, and I'm representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks.
Maybe since it's been a while since this bill was before us, if you could just quickly refresh us on it.
Sure. Our intent with this, and we met again with legislative council, and because it was a little different from what came out with what legislative council came out with than kind of what we presented to him, and it was Harrison Conley, and he said he'd be glad to meet with you. He really felt the way he wrote it up was the best way to approach this, but our concern was in going backward from this time backward. We are trying to protect our record as it exists. We'd like to not have anything redacted from that record, etc. So that was what our aim was. We have been charged with being the keeper of the county records, and we'd like to keep them intact as they were originally recorded. Everything that's there, if there's something what we call extraneous on those documents, it was not something that was required at the time of recording. And we just like to protect those documents going backwards. The other intent was to basically give notice and charge people basically going forward, the public, be careful of what you record. Don't put anything on it that's not a required thing. And, you know, you can use mailing addresses and different things like that rather than a residence address and so forth on documents. So we were just trying to protect the record going backwards and also going forward. So we could keep our land records open. That's the main thing. Our whole state is so dependent on real property records, and we'd hate to see something closed down, as actually happened in a couple of states because of something.
Thank you, Ms. Coleman. Any questions for the county clerk? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming back. And my question is just specifically about the immunity provision, because from your testimony before and from what we talked about, I thought that was a pretty important part of the bill. And now the immunity is for when there's a recording, an instrument that contains non-required information, but it's deleted the other part of the immunity for refusing to remove information. And I just wondered how that came about.
Actually, Chair McPherson and Representative Bonamici, Legislative Council was more concerned with our immunity than we were. So part of that was we asked to have it removed because we're more concerned with the record, quite frankly.
Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, are we going to give overview of what these dash two amendments do, which was the result of discussions that the county clerk had with Legislative Council, to move it more into the intent of what they had in originally begun in this process?
Well, we have the resources you see before you. We have Council Kalmanson, although this he is subbing for another member of the judiciary staff who's regularly assigned to this bill, so he is less familiar with it. And then we have Ms. Coleman. So I'd say those are the resources available to us, Representative. And I'd feel free to ask questions of either one of them as you need.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess because I'm just now reviewing these, I'm just kind of trying to track where everything slots in here.
Just looking structurally at the bill, we're looking at the dash twos, but the dash ones, I understand, are not in play. Is that right, Council, that we're looking just at the bill and the dash twos?
Right, that is my understanding. It's only the dash twos that you're seeking at this point.
Right.
And so what we have is a long insert that is being, you see on the dash twos, starting on line 3. And which can continue over until let's see just where the end of it is here. Ms. Coleman, are you familiar enough with the structure of the dash twos to be able to walk us through this?
It is. It's difficult. I agree. Basically, the original bill starts on page 3, line 13. It goes back to the original bill. A lot of what after that comes is just realigning to the change that was made on page 2, where we are redoing A, B, C, D, and so forth. After page 3, most of that is just realigning other statutes for that change.
So it looks to me as though the insert that's being put into the bill as a new section 1 runs from page 1 of the dash 2s, starting on line 4, continuing until through line 12 of page 3 of the dash 2s.
Correct.
That is adding, that's new material that was not in the original bill. If the affirmative statement that's the bold material on lines 6 through 10 of page 1 is that's the principal insert here, which is the core principle that you're looking to establish, which is that the county clerk shall record documents without regard to whether they have extraneous information.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. and starting basically with section 3, those are just where he's adjusted for when he changed the inserted part.
This is changing what was 1 before to section
2. Okay. Okay. Number 13 does that.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So, Ms. Coleman, is it correct that on the original bill, lines 4 through 7 are still in, and lines 18, the bold on lines 18 and 19 are out? Is that your understanding of what, at least what you wanted to happen?
That looks correct.
Okay. So there would still be a prohibition on once an instrument has been properly filed and recorded, the county clerk may not remove the instrument from the records or redact extraneous information. That would still be in the bill.
That's correct.
And then you're inserting this new requirement that requires you to record an instrument if it contains extraneous information.
That's correct.
Ms. Coleman, remind the committee, what's the nature of the extraneous information you're concerned about?
Mr. Chair, and extraneous, we kind of had a problem with that wordage, but Harrison felt that that was...
Or non-required information.
Non-required is more what we, that's what we term it. It would be things like, such as a social security number or something of that sort that's more of a personal nature. There are statutes that deal with what is required on a document to record. And this would be something in addition that really is not there to have the document put on the record.
Mr. Chair,
I did have a brief conversation with Bill Burgess, who's a Marion County clerk, on this bill, and when our witness here just mentioned about Social Security numbers, I think what this is, what I understand this bill is to try to do from their perspective is to, they have to go back on this microfiche and stuff that was filed years ago and bring up information like that if it was... it wasn't required to have a Social Security number filed at the time, but it accidentally or somehow got filed with a Social Security number on it somewhere in microfiche, have to go back and fish out all this stuff and then change those photos, scratch those photos out. And this is, from what I understand, a bill that would not make them have to go do that. Is that
That's
pretty much
correct.
What...
Right.
Practicality of what this bill would do.
The thing about going backwards, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, if I may. The thing about going backwards is we have a charge, according to our public records law, to keep all this on microfilm, and it's preserved as permanent record forever and ever. If we have to go back and alter this, that certainly is... not good for the preservation of this record at all. Needless to say, it's very expensive. Needless to say, are we ever going to find it all? The other thing is that all these records have already been disseminated to the land industry, records industry. They are all public records, and all the title plants, and everyone has these records already.
So the policy choice, go ahead, Representative Cameron, do you have a question or comment?
The only, maybe the question I would have is let's, and maybe you can help answer this. I understand the complications in going back and doing this, but let's say an individual knows that there's a file on record and they want to go back and refile it or make a change or have their personal information that was unnecessarily filed on that document changed. Is there anything in this bill that would allow them to come to the county clerk and even pay for it on their own to have that information retrieved and refiled or changed?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, no, there isn't. That was part of what we were trying to prevent.
So essentially the policy choice here is that the public record is what it is, even if it includes information that people are now sensitive about having included, and this would tell the county clerks, which is state by law, that they are to maintain that record and to and with under no obligation to redact or delete that kind of information. Even if it had, you know, for Social Security numbers, for example, were a far less sensitive matter,
right,
20 years ago.
Right.
And people routinely put their Social Security numbers on all kinds of documents that they are now much more sensitive about. And so this would be saying the public record for recorded documents is what it is. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At the risk of being hyper-technical, I need some help figuring this out, because on the dash, we're looking at the dash two amendments, and if you look at page 3, line 14, it refers back to the original bill on line 16. And I remember we had a discussion about changing shall to does, and the amendment does that, so that it reads, a county clerk does not incur civil or criminal liability either personally or in official capacity for, but then it deletes everything after it. So I can't find out what follows in the text of the bill on line 16 and 17. I can't find what follows that, because there should be something following that.
I think it only deletes the boldface material. So B would now be A.
But it says...
So it would say for recording or correcting
instrument. Delete the boldfaced?
Yeah.
Okay, so the B is... So it will read for recording a corrected instrument under this section.
Correct.
Got it. Thank you.
It's just changing the paragraph headings a lot. That's what's confusing. It was gross to me.
Right.
Any further questions or comments, committee?
One of the, Mr. Chair, I think it's one of the situations we'd like to be able to help the public clean it up, but we can't. It's not possible, like you said. So this field has to go forward.
I'm just
struggling.
Well, I know how easy it is to go and grab public records. I've done it. And my concern here is, is that because you're getting, are we bringing this bill forward because, and I forgot when we heard this thing, I might not even been here, but are the county clerks being overwhelmed now with people who are saying, I have documents out there that I want to go back and change because I have personal information on those documents, and as a policy in protecting with ID theft and the things that are going on, I guess I want to hear from this. What was the purpose of bringing this bill forward?
Chair McPherson and Representative Cameron, actually, no, we haven't. But it's occurring all over the nation that some of this has been brought up. And actually, some of the states who have adopted some of the different things that people can request to redact, they have said that very few people are doing it. So it was just kind of a proactive something on our part to try to protect our record before it appeared.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I asked the question before, if I came to the clerk with a big permanent Sharpie and asked to see something with my Social Security number on it, which there probably is, because when I moved here from the great Commonwealth of Virginia, my driver's license number was my Social Security number. I couldn't change that. You couldn't pull the record out and let me stand there and block it out. However, if there's something now with personal information on it, I could block it out before it was recorded. So,
Ms. Coleman, is there any experience across the country or in Oregon of identity thieves using publicly recorded documents to get at that kind of information and then misusing it?
Trash.
You know, I'm sure that, I'm sorry, Chair McPherson, I'm sure that there probably, I can't deny that there probably is some, We don't have, we haven't had any here that we know of. But, you know, it is public record and it is out there. So, you know, I can't deny that it's a possibility.
One more comment. Can I suggest that we not publicize this bill too much? I say that with tongue in cheek, but I think we do need to protect the clerks. If the policy is that these are permanent public records, it's a concern. And believe me, I'm first in line to support the ID theft bill that's coming over here from the Senate, and that's going to offer some protections to consumers. But at the same time, I just have a problem with changing something that's a permanent public record. And my sense is that the people who are stealing identities are doing it from people's mail and their mailboxes and from receipts that are in garbage dumps and people's paper recycling and that kind of thing. And there's always going to be somebody who's going to take that extra step to try to find somebody's identity. But let's hope it's not at the standing at the clerk's office.
Yeah, I'll go along with the bill, but just with the knowledge in the back of our mind that if this becomes an issue or there is evidence that that's happening, we need to come back and revisit this issue and find a long-term solution that would protect the citizens of our state.
Just one final comment to the clerk that's here. Is there a program to do away with the microfiche and replace that with putting it on a computer disk? Is that in the future?
Representative McPherson and Representative Pearson of Wisnet, actually, according to state archives, the only permanent record right now is microfilm. Because the thing that explains that is on microfilm you can still look at it and determine what it is. It's technology, you know.
Yeah, I'll do. Yeah.
So.
Thank you.
Okay, committee, we are in work session with the Dash 2 amendments offered up to us. Do I hear a motion on the Dash 2s?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3119.
Representative Cameron moves the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 3119. Is there any discussion? Any objection? If not, the Dash 2 amendments are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 3119 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves House Bill 3119 as amended by the Dash 2 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Could we put that one on a consent calendar? You don't want, okay.
Based on the discussion we had here, I think not.
I think
we probably need to explain it.
Yeah. If there's no further discussion, then the clerk call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Re-excused.
Representative Hawk.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. House Bill 3119, as amended by the Dash 2 amendments, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Cameron, if you'd carry that, I'd be very grateful.
Yes.
I'll close the work session on House Bill 3119, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2241 and stand at ease for a moment while we get to Council Bill Taylor in the room, and we need to alert one of our fellow legislators. The Department of Corrections allows the Department of Corrections discretion in determining the format of its special alternative incarceration treatment program, mandates the program be at least 270 days in duration, measures become effective upon passage. You have the Dash 1 amendments in front of you, and they basically require the program to be evidence-based, allows the program to include intensive self-discipline, physical work, and physical exercise, rather than being based on a military model. We have Scott Taylor from the Department of Corrections signed up. Mr. Taylor. Taylor.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the Judiciary Committee. I'm Scott Taylor, Community Corrections Chief for the Oregon Department of Corrections. I'm here to provide information on House Bill 2241, which was introduced by the governor on behalf of the department. As you may know, the Summit Program was authorized in 1993, and it began operating in 1994. It is down in North Bend, and it was the sole Department of Corrections alternative incarceration program. Since then, Two intensive alternative incarceration addiction programs were authorized by the legislature. House Bill 2241 would permit incremental changes to Summit's boot camp model that is currently acquired in statute, support the ongoing adoption of evidence-based practices, allowing the department to properly respond to changing inmate demographic and program needs. We've had about 17 years to look at the model, continue to study it. The growth in evidence-based practices and knowledge has given us some new information. The 2241 would also allow the department to hold participants in the summit program longer than the 180 days if they're progressing at a slower pace as we're able to do in other programs. This program, as currently written, requires that the program can be no longer than 270 days. That's 6 months of program and 90 days of transitional leave. And what we would like to do is have the language match that of the intensive addictions alternative incarceration program, which allows us to hold people in if we have a sense in those final days that they still need a little more time to get the message or learn something, rather than running up against a timeline mandating that we let them out or we return them to the institution. We'd like a little more flexibility in that. We believe these changes are necessary to continue to live at the summer program consistent with 267 and the ongoing research. The Dash 1 amendments that you have before you were developed out of the recent discussions we've had with the representative of the Oregon District Attorney's Association. Department agreed to amend our original bill language to clarify and clearly define in statute that changes to the summit program shall reflect evidence-based practices and that the summit shall include a component of intensive self-discipline, physical work, and physical exercise. We'd also like to state on the record today that the department will not expand the alternative incarceration program without first notifying the courts, the District Attorney's Association, and Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And the Oregon Department of Corrections respectfully requests the committee adopt the Dash 1 amendments and move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Available for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. I think it might be helpful to the committee to understand the history of the boot camp program, because really this bill is really more about boot camp than it is about alternative incarceration per se. So it might be helpful for people to hear that history.
Yes, I'll try. Chair McPherson. When we first formed the boot camp in 1994, it was very popular throughout the nation. We sent a variety of folks to different states where we're running boot camps, and we came back and developed an Oregon model of the boot camp. So our boot camp involved a military regimen, marching, physical activity in the morning, exercise, a lot of that kind of work, and then we also added a great deal of cognitive work within the boot camp model. As time has gone on and research has looked at the whole around the nation, the military part of it and just that piece, it has found that that did not deliver the change that we had all hoped and felt it was going to deliver. The discipline, the learning, the self-discipline, the ongoing physical, all still are things we think we can fit into an overall program that is different than our addiction program and focused on learning self-discipline, learning how to manage stress and situations. And so as the program has gone along, we've continued to study it. We've continued to look at the results we're getting from it and the research around the whole program. And now that we have the intensive alcohol and drug programs running for both the women and the men, we would like to have this program be more and more focused on those who do not necessarily suffer from that same degree of addiction and are in need of some very focused self-discipline and the cognitive change. Is that helpful, sir?
It is helpful. Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a lot of questions, and I don't want to be part of a legislature that micromanages your program, but I have in my district, the Oregon Youth Challenge Program, which is, I understand, is treating different kind of problems, dropouts versus criminals. But that program is there's no question it's successful. So what is the research that says the military style, you know, program is failing? And I guess another question along with that is, what is the age? Is there an age limit that we put into the boot camp?
Chairman Pearson, Representative Wisnett, for the first part, and I want to be clear, a lot of what we would do would resemble the military model as far as the discipline, the movements, the interaction that goes on within the staff. What we are finding is that the military model in and of itself has a short duration upon termination of the program. So when they leave those and they come out into real life and people aren't moving, talking, doing that kind of, these folks need a lot of cognitive work. That's where we found the cognitive and the self-discipline and learning how to manage yourself was essential more than the military. So what we're trying to do is be able to adjust the program so it will still have a very intensive beginning like you would experience at boot camp, but the ability to transition people to dealing more with their own self management as they get closer to the end of the program. The age. 18, we move people there.
Maximum.
Beginning, I'm sorry, from 18 to 65.
Is no
or, as long as they can physically, if the summit program is located down in North Bend up on an old military radar base, and the physical location requires that for a certain group of people, it's very difficult terrain.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Taylor. I mean, I'm not going to. I support evidence-based programs, and I'll leave that up to you and Director Williams. But the bill is where we're making the changes. We got, going from shell to May, but then we're still leaving one May in there. We're leaving May included drug and alcohol. So, I mean, is that assuming the person doesn't have an addiction? Is that why you want that to be May?
Chairman Fisson, Representative Resnick, the reason we wanted to adjust that was with the alternative incarceration intensive addiction programs. We are trying to sort out the people that have the intensive addiction and move them to that program. These folks we would like to still consider having some alcohol and drug there if it seems appropriate, but we may find as we work with this program that it is not as critical there. So we wanted to have some flexibility about the degree of the intensity of the need for the alcohol and drug treatment there.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about the change on line 14. It used to say shall be no longer than 270 days, and now it's changing it to shall be at least 270 days. And it looks like it's been shorter than that, but there's apparently no minimal fiscal impact. So I'm trying to figure out how we can go to something that didn't have a definite time frame to something that has to be at least 270 days without additional expense.
Chairman Pearson, Representative Bonamici, the current language does require us a minimum of 270 days or a maximum of 270 days. And so we put people in and they do 180 days in the institution typically and then 90 days in transitional service or transitional leave. What this says to us is similar to the intensive addictions program, that when you reach that 180 days when you're getting ready, if we say we think we need another month with you, we can go ahead and extend you to 300 days. What we typically face now is either recycling the people or returning them to general population. So these people would still continue to work with them because we've invested all that time and resource in trying to get the change. We'd like the ability to, in certain cases, and in a class, we may have as two or three people that we feel if we can put some more time into them, we might actually get the benefit we've been working on.
Thank you.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Taylor, for your testimony. And follow up along with Representative Wisnett's comments, I too don't want to micromanage. You guys know your business. Have you looked when he brought up the Oregon Youth Authority, listening to in Ways and Means and General Caldwell and some of the testimony we heard there, what are some of the differences between the military model that you are asking to have flexibility with and the Oregon Youth Authority's program that they're getting some good success with? and some of the things that they're doing that you guys have looked at that might carry over into this new flexible program.
Chairman McPherson and Representative Cameron, I have not spent time at the specific program the Youth Authority operates, so I can't speak with any knowledge about what are the differences. I can give you a basic idea of the kinds of things that we currently manage that we would like some flexibility with, if that would be helpful.
I don't need to probably hear all those, but that might be a good idea to visit with. Is there anything that they're doing because of the great success they're having that could be adapted into the new flexibility you're asking for?
Chairman McPherson, thank you. Representative Cameron will make sure we do that. And I wanted to be clear. It was not whenever we talk about the military, there's always a fear that we are abandoning the entire model. What we're trying to do here is keep the best features of that and have some flexibility in how we manage that out. We do recognize there's some benefits, particularly with the kind of effort we're trying to make here with this group of people.
Thank you.
Thank you. And just briefly, thank you, Mr. Taylor, for your testimony. But Representative Wisnett, we've had testimony over the past couple of sessions about how just the plain shouting in your face stuff isn't productive, and it wasn't accomplishing what they wanted. And so before Max Williams was in charge there, we talked about trying to move that to a results-based program, and that's what they're trying to do. Because some of the things they were doing before just didn't work with the criminals. I mean, you could make them stand up and do what you're told for that minute, but they were learning that if you're bigger and stronger and can yell louder than you're in charge, they'd return to the street with that attitude, which wasn't helpful.
Thank you.
Representative Kahn.
And just to comment, the boot camp that is the Youth Authority, there is a big difference between what's happening there and what this program is discussing, I believe, and that is all the students have to be drug free. They can't have any addictions before they even start the program, and they pledge that they're going to stay drug free. And once if they break that pledge, then they're out. So I would think that would be a pretty prime ingredient for differences in the programs.
Any further questions? Then I'm going to Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I know that Representative Thatcher was wanting to...
Right, and so I was planning to do, actually, is to close the public hearing, but then move on to other business so that she would have a chance to finish her testimony and get up here to
thank
make
you
a presentation.
For your consideration.
Very good. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. And to the chair and to the members of the committee that looked at this in the past, I mentioned micromanaging. Is this necessary to have legislation to dictate what kind of, because we have 376 that says you must use evidence based. We look at that during the budget cycle. I have a friend who's an ex-mayor of Coronado says my job is to get rid of bills, not create bills. So, is any committee, chair or Mr. Chair?
Well, I think what they're just trying to do is give them some more flexibility. Make it clear that they have the flexibility. As Administrator Taylor has pointed out, in the past, the original programs, what they discovered they were doing was turning out disciplined crooks. It was they learned discipline, but they didn't learn how not to be crooks. And so,
Council Taylor,
two members of the committee, Mr. Taylor, if I remember correctly, we've had presentations from researchers that you've been here, and some of them were presented by the Department of Corrections. And my recollection was, and tell me if I'm wrong, that without other components which you have, cognitive restructuring, drug treatment, that the research shows that straight boot camps increase the likelihood that someone is to recidivate when they come out, and also that they're more likely to be better disciplined crooks.
Chairman McPherson, Council Taylor, I won't go as far as the disciplined crooks, but I will say that we have pretty clear information that the military model in and of itself does not get the change and actually does increase recidivism in some cases.
Thanks. If there are no further questions for Mr. Taylor, then I'm going to recess the public hearing on House Bill 2241, and we'll get input from Representative Thatcher when she becomes available. And we'll open a work session on House Bill 2382. Maybe I spoke too soon. Let's, Representative Thatcher, if you want to catch your breath for a moment, I just recessed. I'll bring out of recess the public hearing we had on House Bill 2241.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Had another hearing in another committee. Last week, I testified on another AIP-related bill that, oh, for the record, I'm Kim Thatcher, representative from Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh. Apologize for that. And I suggested an amendment, and it would be an amendment that basically brings some more accountability and helps, I think, the legislature and the Department of Corrections make some better and informed decisions on the directions of these programs offered through the Department of Corrections. And the amendment just adds in audits for the Secretary of State to, audit the program so that there's more accountability. And I would just offer that amendment, the same amendment, essentially, as I had offered last week, and that's all I have for you.
And do we have that amendment before us?
It should have been brought down here. 2241.
We have dash ones here. Do you have any other?
It should be a dash two. I'll bring that to you. There was supposed to be 20 copies brought down for this.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Thatcher. And I completely agree with you. You need accountability and audit. I've been approached by the Secretary of State's office that they feel they're not qualified. Would you be opposed to having DOC, contractor arrange for the audit from private instead of going through?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisden, I think it's important that a detached party do it, so whoever does it needs to be not in the thick of it. They just need to be give a good objective audit.
Thank you. So.
Representative Thatcher, could you describe what you said to bring accountability to alternative incarceration? The House Bill 2241, although it refers to alternative incarceration, it's really about the boot camp instead of Shutter Creek. And so how do your amendments affect the proposal that the Department of Corrections brought forward?
Well, this amendment would direct the Secretary of State's office to annually perform a performance audit on all alternate incarceration programs. Specifically, I mean, it lists a bunch of things, but I think the thing we want to get at is what is the rate of recidivism for participants who successfully complete the program over a 5-year period and compare that with those who do not go through it and see which programs are really working, which ones are effective, so we can make informed decisions on how to proceed with the program or modify it or change it, however, in the future.
Mr. Chair? We have word that they may be somewhere in the building, but they were never delivered to the judiciary staff office, and so
Mr.
we don't
Chair.
Have them in hand here. So I think that's all the input. I think what I'll do is close the public hearing on this bill, and then when we have those amendments, then we can go into work session and consider that impact. Questions.
Maybe I need some clarification. The dash ones shall reflect evidence-based practices. What does the evidence-based practices mean or include? Council, can you help us?
Chairman of the committee, Representative Cameron, evidence-based practices goes back to a bill that was passed two sessions ago. And what it really does is you take your program that you have here, you go to the research literature and compare the two programs to see what they call basically fidelity studies. How truthful are you to that program? It's one difficulty when doing actual outcome studies is expense involved. The fact is that sometimes, especially for a small program, the expense of researching to see what your results are can be more expensive than the program.
Right.
So across the board and all the treatment programs that we have, what we did two sessions ago, require that all our treatment programs be evidence-based, a certain percentage of money, which goes up every 2 years. So I think it tops out at 75%.
Thank you. members, you just had handed to you the Dash 2 amendments, and so if there are any questions that you would like to ask of Representative Thatcher about the Dash 2s, or we could get Mr. Taylor back up if you had questions about what impact the Dash 2s might have on the Department of Corrections, if that were of interest. That's probably a good idea.
Mr. Chair, I think it's a good idea to make sure that the programs that we're passing are actually working the way they're intended, but now I have a concern that Representative Wisnett raised about whether the Secretary of State's office is the entity that should be making that assessment. So I don't know how we can handle that with this amendment, which specifically requires the audit to be done by Secretary of State.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bonovich, I have a suggestion for Representative Thatcher that could be the Criminal Justice Commission could perform the audits. That would be their heavy expertise in this area.
Mr. Chair,
of course.
I'm interested in this discussion, although I perhaps would have to counter that the Secretary of State's office would not be the appropriate entity. That office has the statutory authority to do audits in various areas, and to and that ostensibly is an independent entity without a specific interest in. And so I would be less comfortable with the Representative Wisnett's suggestion, and I think that the Secretary of State's office would be an appropriate entity to do an overview review objectively.
Any we're in public hearing still at this point, so let's see if there's input that we need to get from Representative Thatcher, from Mr. Taylor here to, in order to inform ourselves. Representative Krieger.
Chair, Secretary of State's office doesn't have extra expertise in every audit, but they go get that information from those who do it. I think they're very capable of doing it, and they actually have the process set up to do it.
Mm-hmm. Any further questions, or would you like to hear from Mr. Taylor? I think we should hear from Scott Taylor from the Department of Corrections, since this takes the bill off in a completely different direction from what the printed bill and the Dash 1 amendments would do.
Chair McPherson, again for the record, I'm Scott Taylor, Chief of Community Corrections for the Oregon Department of Corrections. We really haven't had a chance to look at the Dash 2. I've just been reading them. I guess we'd like a chance to think more about the issues in here. As I quickly scan this, I will say that the evidence base requirement, the 267 requirements, and the information that we report to the legislature, and the variety of the issues that are in here are, for example, as Mr. Taylor said, the rate of recidivism and stuff is an ongoing issue that we do report, willing to report. Criminal Justice Commission, those we work regularly with those individuals in reporting out, I think, the majority of the material that's here. If the legislature felt another body needed to look at those results, I will just say that a few of these things take some extensive reaching in and looking at data and information, and we're always happy to share or willing to share any of the information about this program with the legislature or to report if that was its desire on these specific issues, more specifically requested, but would like a chance to. I haven't analyzed all the different things that bill would require.
Very good. Representative Krieger.
I would assume this amendment would cause a revenue impact.
Fiscal impact. In fact, the bill with the Dash 1 amendments, there is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means in the bill, and we have had got approval to rescind that subsequent referral based on the Dash 1 amendments. But with the Dash 2s, that we would not be able to rescind it because there would be a fiscal impact of requiring such an audit, so it would have to go to Ways and Means. So I think one of the choices or the considerations here is we've got a bill that deals with a with the boot camp that has no fiscal, that is a, I would say, it's got a limited kind of policy choice behind it, and then we've got another policy choice that's being offered up to us now that is has a fiscal impact. And at this stage in the session, if it goes off to Ways and Means, the prospects for the bill are not nearly so good as they are if it moves in a more clean way. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to ask a question of Mr. Taylor. I know we just got the dash twos, but they require the audit to consider the number of inmates, the length of sentence imposed and served, and the nature of the crime, and the number of participants, and the rate of recidivism, and a comparison. You may have already said this. I guess I'm just looking for confirmation. Do you keep that information? Do you currently gather that information in the normal course? And if so, is it available?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici. Yes, we currently collect that, and we continue to work with our research department to try and get cleaner and cleaner research-matched samples and those sorts of things. So those items you listed are information we have available.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Representative Cameron.
Yeah, the one that stands out, and I maybe Representative Thatcher or Mr. Taylor can comment on it, as on line 16. This is on the dash twos, line 16, 17. Recidivism is measured over a 5-year period. Everything that I've kind of looked at, it sounds like I've always thought we're measuring recidivism over a 3-year period. Am I right in that?
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron. Yes, at the current and the pattern for the Department of Corrections for as long as I've been associated, we've looked at a 3-year conviction for a new felony as a record. We have the ability to look longer.
Okay. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, the focus of House Bill 2241 with the dash one amendments is to a specific program. Do I understand correctly? Specific
yes.
Program, mm-hmm. Which is an alternative incarceration program, correct? then if the amendments that Representative Thatcher is proposing by virtue of her dash twos are also up for consideration in another bill, which applies to alternative incarceration programs, and the audit function in I would suggest that we consider an audit function is different than gathering information, research, compiling a report by an entity that's responsible for providing this program or engaging in this program. Audit function is different than record keeping and reporting. maybe it is that the dash two amendments in the other bill that we are considering would then apply to this program as well. So I'm just trying to think of a way not to deter the primary purpose of 2241 if there seems to be a lack of enthusiasm to specifically insert an audit provision into this bill, but there the other alternative incarceration bill is an area that would apply to all programs, including this one.
Right.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to interrupt, but this is exactly the same as the amendment offered in 2329. It was the dash five amendments. It's the exact same.
So we have another bill that's under active consideration by the committee in which this policy choice has been presented as well. I would say at this point, I think maybe we've gathered all the input we need, and so what we should do is close the questions.
One more question. Representative Thatcher, would you object to changing the and I'm just thinking of this from Ways and Means and consistency here when we're talking about recidivism. Would you object to changing your amendment if it was adopted to a 3-year period instead of a 5-year period, so we're always comparing apples to apples?
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, if that would make this more sellable, yes, I would be happy
Thank
to
you.
Change that.
There are no further questions then. Let me close the public hearing on House Bill 2241 and open a work session on House Bill 2241. And so I think the question, committee, is whether we should take a bill that can move directly to the floor that it deals with the narrow policy choices about the boot camp format, or whether we should be putting an audit for AIP more generally into this bill vehicle, sending it to Ways and Means at this stage in the session. Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, it's the policy choice of the original bill. If we like that, you add this to it, you're not going to end up with it because it's going to die in Ways and Means. The audit can be added in a different year. It can be looked at in the other bills that if we look at all these incarceration programs.
Okay. Any further comments, discussion? Then that would point toward adoption of the Dash 1 amendments. Do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move Dash 1s into 2241.
Representative Barker moves the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2241. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? The Dash 1s are in.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2241 to the floor with the due pass.
And the rescission of the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Prior referral to Ways and Means. Do you understand that to be in the motion?
Yes.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2241 as amended with a due pass recommendation to the floor and rescission of the prior reference to prior referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion of the motion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Hammond.
Aye.
Representative Floyd.
Aye.
Representative
Cox.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wilson.
Aye.
Chairman Person.
Aye.
House Bill 2241 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Representative Reed, would you like to carry that bill?
Please do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2241 and open a work session on House Bill 2382. Council Kalmanson will remind us about this bill, which is from this now seems like the dark past of our session.
It was 2 months ago today that this bill was first heard by this committee. It concerns procedures for establishing and disestablishing paternity. You remember there were Dash 1s. This was a gut and stuff bill, so the Dash 1s was the original Oregon Law Commission draft, and there were also Dash 3s that were before the committee, or at least in draft form. And there were some differences between the Dash 1s and Dash 3s. The biggest difference relating to the discretion of the court in a situation where someone can prove that paternity was originally established because of fraud and subsequent blood tests prove that the legal father is not the biological father, and there was a question about how much discretion the court should have in those instances to not disestablish paternity. And there have been many discussions since that hearing, and there are Dash 4s now before the committee, which are, I believe, be the consensus amendments amongst the Law Commission Paternity Work Group. And what the Dash 4s do, they clarify the discretion of the court to disestablish paternity after a finding of fraud. The amendments establish that if a court finds by preponderance of the evidence that a voluntary acknowledgement was signed because of fraud, duress, or material mistake of fact, the court shall set aside the acknowledgement unless, after giving consideration to the interest of the parties and the child, the court finds that doing so would be substantially inequitable. The amendments also establish that if a court finds that a paternity judgment was obtained as a result of fraud, misconduct, mistake, or excusable neglect, and blood tests establish that the man is not the biological father, the court shall vacate the paternity judgment unless, after giving consideration to the interest of the parties and the child, the court finds that that doing so would be substantially inequitable.
Committee, what you have here now in the Dash 4s is, I think, a compromise that has brought the parties together. And my understanding, I'll just kind of look to the back of the room, that this is a consensus, as this was described, and I see nodding heads, that this is a consensus amendment. Does anybody feel they need any more input from any of the participants in this process? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the inquiry and consensus among stakeholders, including Matt Commonson, who had the...
Or Matt Minahan.
Minahan, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Not Council Commonson.
On fire.
unless there's a vested interest here.
He is a recent dad, though. So.
Question that after the spill. She looks like me.
So Matt was part of the discussion that brought this to consensus as well. Do I understand a nod came
yes,
from that
yes,
area
he was.
As well?
He has been nodding his head.
Okay.
And,
I didn't
Manhan,
see him
wanna,
back there.
You want to come forward and just and actually let's have others get, kind of make that record as well for the committee's benefit.
Ken Minney, my name is Matt Minahan. I represent Dad's America. I am glad to say that 2 years after Representative Krieger directed us to find justice, and with a lot of work from the Oregon Law Commission and the continued persistence of this body to pursue sound policy, I'm glad to say that we have, at least on our part, reached consensus and are very happy with this bill. We appreciate the hard work everybody has put into this.
I'm Sandra Hansberger. I am a member of the Oregon Law Commission. I was chair of the Uniform Parentage Act work group. I just want to correct, and you are correct in that this was a consensus that we were able to reach, but due to time constraints, we were not able to take this back to the full work group, which, as you recall, consisted of about 40 different members. What we did instead was talk with the key players, the folks who had testified here before you, and we did bring the matter back to the full commission just because of the time constraints. The full commission voiced no objection to the dash fours. So that's where we are. I just wanted to clarify that it wasn't the work group.
Very good.
And thank you again for helping us facilitate this process.
Add to that. Okay, thank you very much. Representative Krieger.
I just want to express the appreciation I have for all the work that was done for people who are a long ways apart, didn't want to deal with it. Sometimes you got to deal with things you don't want to deal with, and I think out of that comes that thing that I told Matt 2 years ago, make them go have some justice for as close as we can get to it. I think you've done that. Appreciate it.
Any further questions of any of these witnesses? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we're in work session. We have the dash four amendments before us. Do I hear a motion? Representative Krieger.
I'll move the dash four amendments into House Bill 2382.
Representative Krieger moves the dash four amendments into House Bill 2382. Is there any discussion?
Just a question to Council. This encompasses everything that was in the dash one, we don't need any other amendments, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, it's the dash ones with that one change. If there's no further discussion, is there any objection? If not, then the dash four amendments are in the bill.
And Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2382 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2382 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative
Forrest.
Aye.
Representative
Clark.
Aye.
Representative
Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Barker. Aye.
Vice Chair
Winters. Aye. Chairman Spurgeon. Aye. House Bill 2382 as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Krieger, would you carry that?
I
appreciate it.
Thank
I'll close the work session on House Bill 2382 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3129. Council Kalmanson. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3129 establishes that if a non-PERS public employer imposes an income tax, the employer must either exempt all local, state, and federal retirees from the tax or increase benefits to compensate the police officer or firefighter retirees for the taxation of their retirement benefits. The bill prohibits non-PERS public employees from prohibits non-PERS public employers from decreasing other benefits by reason of the increases mandated by this bill. There are also dash one amendments before the committee. The dash one amendments delete the requirements on the non-PERS public employers that I just described. Instead, it establishes that a local government may impose an income tax on local, state, and federal retirees only if all retired police officers or firefighters who are employed by a non-PERS public employer are provided benefit increases to compensate them for the taxation of their retirement benefits. and the non-PERS public employer does not decrease any other benefits because of the increases mandated by this bill.
We have Joe Esray.
No, Joe Gray.
Gray.
Yeah.
I think Gray. A subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Couldn't read this writing here. Joel Gray, I beg your pardon. All right, Mr. Gray.
I'm Joe Gray, president of the Portland Retired Firefighters. I'm here with Bob Roberts, who is president of the Portland Retired Police Officers. And I would like to bring to your attention this situation that I think was an accidental thing. And we ended up finding out that through Multnomah County tax, income tax, that we were the only public employees basically in the state that weren't covered by an exemption that is allowed by state law. So consequently, although the state itself has a we fall under that state law that says that we'll be made whole on our pensions if from state tax. The county, we found when the county implemented their tax that we fell through a hole someplace and we weren't included in that situation. So we were told after a lot of work with number of different the city county situation in the Portland Multnomah area that we would have to have some legislation that would cover us. Now this is not just to cover us in Multnomah County, but anywhere in the state where other fire and police are covered into this situation. So it's a thing that we're not asking anything different than what every other firefighter and police officer, state and county, city firefighter and police officer in the state of Oregon already has, with the exception of the city of Portland Fire and Police, and that is due to the fact that we have a different pension situation. We're not covered under PERS, and so consequently we didn't fall under the strict guidelines of the court, Supreme Court ruling that said that when the state started to tax public employees' pensions in 1995, the Supreme Court said that they could not tax the PERS employees, and if they did, they would have to make them whole. Well, we actually have, through legislation, came under the same situation, and we're in that position right now. Our pension is making us whole on the state tax, and so that's not a problem. What we did find a problem was when Multnomah County initiated an income tax, we found that somewhere we slipped through the hole, and we were the only people in the state of Oregon that are public employees as such that weren't covered under this basic exemption. So that's what we're here asking for, is that the Portland Fire and Police be treated basically the same as all the rest of the public employees in the state of Oregon. And this also includes federal employees because under the Davis Act, the federal government says you have to treat federal employees the same as you do your state employees. So consequently, all the federal employees, your postal workers, your Forest Service, and any other federal employees, FBI, and people that we work with are covered in those situations, with the exception, again, is the only few that aren't is the Portland Fire and Police, sworn Portland Fire and Police officers. All our office personnel are covered, but not the sworn officers themselves. So, and this, we hope, will resolve that situation, and that's what we're asking for legislation to be passed to take care of that problem.
Mr. Gray, even though I'm a pension lawyer in my other life, I'd I have to say there's a long and complex and tortured history to the taxation of pensions in Oregon. Something that does, if I think I recall correctly, it's service before a date in the early 90s that is exempt from, the benefits based on those were exempt from tax, and that was changed. And then there's a benefit increase in lieu of that non-taxability that's provided to PERS retirees, but it's not based on, it's not their entire pension, it's the portion that was earned before a certain date in the early 90s. Am I remembering that
correctly? That's right. It was, they decided to tax in 1991, and prior to 1991, the tax was, those people were held completely whole. Anything after 1991, then they fell into a taxable situation.
Now, as I read this bill, it would apply though to the entire benefit, not to just the portion earned before that date in 1991. That's the crossover point for PERS. Is that right?
That's true. Okay.
And Mr. Chair, this is for special taxes like Multnomah County did a temporary income tax, and that would cover that. It doesn't cover. I mean, I pay tax on my post 1991 pension earnings vested interest after 91. I do get an offset for those prior years. But this would cover it's just a very unusual little piece that fell through the cracks where retired port and police and firefighters who live in Multnomah County when they imposed that tax, they had to pay the tax on their income where their next-door neighbor who might have been a District 10 firefighter who was in PERS didn't have to pay it. And this is, as you know, pensions that are not in PERS are supposed to be equal to or better than. And this just makes it a little more fair. The probability of this coming up is fairly minute. The amount of money is actually would be pretty small, but it's just an issue of fairness for the firefighters. It could affect me if Washington County was to impose, or if I was to move to another county where they imposed a temporary income tax of some sort. But there again, my next door neighbor who was a PERS retiree wouldn't have to do that. And this is also a last man's club as the new employees in Portland Police and Fire are now an OPSERP.
Yeah, that's true.
So it won't, I mean, this is going to die off before too many years.
Representative Krieger.
For a while, I hope.
Mr. Chair.
Whoa! Yeah. Some sooner than others.
It might be interesting, Mr. Chair, if maybe, I don't know it exactly. But as I recall, the exemption from taxation was given as an offer, I believe, by the state of Oregon and other bargaining units back sometime, I can't remember what it was, in lieu of a pay increase during a biennium to hold costs down.
The public employees were not to be taxed on retirement in Oregon, under Oregon.
Yeah, but that was part of that was the result of a change. So there was something given up for a period of time to get that exemption from taxation, and then they went back and started taxing it, and then the court overruled it.
It was very tortured and complicated, as you said.
Yeah. Further questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Cameron. I always want to make sure I got this clear. So if you moved out of Multnomah County, came down here to Salem, you wouldn't be paying this tax.
Right.
That's right.
I didn't pay it. I didn't pay it.
Come on down to Salem. We'd love to have more people that can generate our economy here.
Well, we have, Mr. Chairman, we have people spread all over the state of Oregon, all over the United States, and some of them in foreign countries. So we're definitely spread out. Retirees have a tendency to migrate. And so, consequently, they're not all concentrated, even though they worked in the city of Portland. In our particular case, they're not all concentrated there by any means. As a matter of fact, they after they retired, they moved out of those areas substantially.
And is it the case, Mr. Graham, that as to PERS benefits, or that the counterpart, that the basic benefit itself, there is an increase in lieu of the state tax. So,
yes.
Yeah, and that those people who move elsewhere outside of Oregon get that increase, continue to get that increase. Is that right?
Yes, that's true. In fact, they're trying to make a change in that situation right now, and in my opinion, it should be changed. If they're in an area where they don't they're not required to pay the tax, they certainly shouldn't have the increase, the compensation for paying the tax.
We had a bill.
Yeah,
sorry, that last session.
Pat, did you want to? This is a bit, I may have taken this thing off topic, so don't feel like you need to comment on that. But.
And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Pat West. Represent the Oregon State Firefighters Council, and I think the one thing that's missing is that in 1995, when the settlement was reached, where the taxation 1990 backwards, those benefits, they received a tax increase and then paid the taxes on it. In the settlement, after it went to the Supreme Court and came down, the Oregon legislature, part of that settlement was that there would not be any local or county income taxes imposed as part of the settlement, because the theory being that if they moved it from a state tax to a local or a county tax, then you wouldn't have had the settlement. So that's in fact in the state law. So virtually every other PERS employee, as Joe Gray says, receives that benefit or protection, however you want to view it, with the exception of the Portland Fire and Police. And the only we tried in the settlement in 1995, we tried to think of everything, and we did get the commensurate increase for the Portland Fire and Police for the years prior to 1990, but we missed this, and somehow we didn't realize that there was an exclusion, and never foresaw that Multnomah County would implement an income tax. So anyway, that's the history. That's the little, I think, element that was missing as to you were trying to figure out how it happened, and that is it.
Okay. Any questions for either Mr. Gray or Mr. West? Representative Flores.
Thank you. The reference that Representative Barker made to Last Man's Club and is included in Mr. Gray's letter. So how many people are we talking about that this would apply to? What is the cohort that we're talking about?
Representative McPherson and Representative Flores, the about 1,500 total people between fire and police are retired from the fire and police pension fund at any given time, and they of course that one end of them disappears, and the other end of them picks up, unfortunately. So it's a fairly
fluid
standard situation, but as time rolls on, that's going to change because of the fact that all new employees of the Portland Fire and Police are going to be under PERS, and so it'll be a moot situation over time.
That's new hires since the first of 07. So yeah. Everybody who was hired before January 1, 07, even the youngest public safety people are going to be still in the police and fire system of the city of Portland.
But 60 years, they'll all be gone.
Okay. In 60 years?
About that, yeah.
Okay, so but we're talking about approximately 1,500
people.
Individuals
that slowly goes
in
down.
Perpetuity or yeah. 60 years, whichever comes first.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, yeah, I'm curious. I'm looking for I think the income tax is, Multnomah income tax has gone away currently. And does this bill help you recover any of the income tax you've already paid?
No, sir.
And is there?
They're not asking for that. They just want to be in the future to have it fair.
Well, is there anything this committee could do to
start World War III?
All right. I'm serious. If they were treated unfairly in this situation, is there?
Take it out of the mayor's fund.
All right, I guess I'm going to withdraw what I just said. But I
that would thank you for your. I appreciate that, but that would really complicate things.
Representative Flores.
Last quick question. Thank you, and Representative Cameron did bring up the point because I was thinking, fuck that Multnomah County tax went away. So we're talking about something that's rather preemptive in the event they would, Multnomah County would once again impose
or
a tax.
Or any county.
Or any county.
In Oregon.
Well, I'm glad we included that because I know Representative Wisnett wouldn't want to do this for a specific entity.
If there are no further questions, we've got one other witness. Why don't we excuse these gentlemen and Paul Snyder.
Fire from my fair board.
I won't reply.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. Mr. Chair, I signed up primarily to hear the explanation from the previous witnesses in case there were some issues that we might have based on what they had to say. The original printed bill did not seem to me, when I looked at it, to accomplish the goals that I assumed were the purpose of the bill, but I think the Dash 1 amendments may clarify that. So, in essence, I'm here to say I have nothing to say.
Well, let me ask you a question since you've come up to offer yourself, Mr. Snyder. We have a prohibition on unfunded mandates with respect to local governments. Could this implicate that issue of our Constitution, which is that what we're saying is you've got to give a benefit increase to this class of person, and we haven't funded it if we just wait this, and this is very good ways through ways and means and have an appropriation. So what is there any concern about that issue?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's not something I had thought about until you just raised it. I'm not aware of any county that currently has an income tax. And there are, as I understand it, 10 counties that are not in PERS that must therefore provide equal to or better than benefits. So this might apply, or the original printed bill might have applied. This bill, with the Dash 1 amendments, would be somewhat different from that. And so if we have to provide equal to or better than benefits, and those benefits therefore must be compared with those that are received by PERS employees, I frankly don't know the answer to that question.
Mr. Chair, if we could not work this today, and I'll bring in an amendment to say that they just don't have to pay it, rather than requiring Multnomah County to pay some, or requiring Portland or whoever to pay somebody else, that they just would be exempt from paying it. Okay. And also, I want to change one word on line 3 to be sure it says personal income at the request of Mr. Landauer.
Okay.
But I think that would solve that problem so we're not imposing a cost. It would just be they wouldn't collect it.
Just very briefly, Brian DeLashman, Oregon Council of Police Association. Just to clarify, Mr. Snyder had indicated there was 10 counties that are non-PERS. There's actually just 10 jurisdictions, not 10 counties. City of Springfield is one. So there potentially could be 10 counties in which there's a jurisdiction that is a non-PERS employer, but there are not 10 counties that are non-PERS employers. And we would look at the Dash 1 or Dash 2s to make sure that we, in fact, protected those in the future the same way as we're talking with specifically to Portland.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really endorse Representative Barker's proposal, because when I talked to Mr. Gray on this, I didn't like the way it was done to pay, you know, and just exempt them with the other people. I think it's a much cleaner bill.
Good. If those are all the questions, then let's close the public hearing and get those amendments prepared. And so I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3129. That concludes our agenda for today. Just a reminder, we have noticed our meeting starting on Monday at 8 a.m.
Yay!
And if we can't, we're going to have some long agendas coming up for the next 2 weeks, committee. And if we can't complete them within our allotted time in the morning, we may have to go back into evening session. So we'll try to avoid that, but have that in mind as we move through the work to be done. We are adjourned. Okay.